Live from Abu Dhabi, this is The Breakfast Show with Kate Jones on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to another one of my breakfast shows. I'm very excited to be here. Today I will be joined by the Teacher Delusion Trilogy author, that is Bruce Robertson. So that will be a great conversation. And I'll also be talking about parents evening. So if you're listening live, please do join the conversation.
Live from Abu Dhabi, this is The Breakfast Show with Kate Jones on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're well, and I hope you can hear me, because last week we had a technical issue. But nevertheless, the interview with Daisy Christodoulou was shared as a podcast. So if you missed that, please do listen back. It was a really interesting interview. Daisy Christodoulou is very intelligent and witty and kind, and I just loved talking to her. Thank you, Dorian. Dorian, who will be hosting later today, has said he can hear me loud and clearly, which is always good on a radio show. So I really appreciate that. If you are listening live, please do tell me where in the world that you are listening from. So before I'm joined by my guest, Bruce Robertson, Bruce will be joining us today at 7:30. He's very kindly taken some time out of his busy morning and schedule because he's in school. But I thought I would talk about Parents Evening. I've recently done another Parents Evening. It was a Meet the Tutor evening because I'm a Year 7 form tutor this term. And it was a 5-minute conversation. Hello, introduce myself. Explain how the child is settling in. It was very different to a subject-specific parents' evening. I was not able to comment on how children are doing in a range of subjects. It was purely pastoral. So there's lots of things like that going on, and that was absolutely lovely. And I think that's really important, especially with Year 7, for the transition process. It was really important to, you know, for the parents to just see me and to just hear that their child is settling in well and everything is going well and there's no concerns, because if there were concerns, I obviously would have been in touch sooner. So that was online, that was via School Cloud, because of the regulations and so on. So how that works, if anyone hasn't done an online parents' evening, is that parents will get the schedule, and there's 5-minute slots, and they have to book their 5-minute slot. And we did this last academic year, as many other schools did, an online parents' evening. And then I was a bit of a convert. I thought it actually worked really well. I wrote an article for the TES. Oh, good morning, Tom Rogers, my dear friend Tom, listening from Liverpool. You can hear me, Tom, which is brilliant. So yes, I wrote an article for the TES about why I liked online parents' evening, and it was just an opinion piece, and I knew not everyone would agree with me, and that's absolutely fine. And I did write context is key, because I tweeted it out again recently, and it is. I'm in Abu Dhabi. All of our families have access to a laptop and Wi-Fi. That certainly isn't the case everywhere. So I'm really keen to explore parents' evening. We all know why we have parents' evening. Conversations with parents, carers, families are incredibly important. So it's not about the why. We all agree these should be happening. It's more about the how. How should we go about parents' evening? Oh, hello. And we've got a comment in saying, I like online parents' evening too. Yes, it's the countdown in the last 30 seconds that's a bit stressful. Now, that is a bit stressful, but the timer, so for anyone who doesn't realise, if you haven't used an online parents' evening, there is a timer that literally gives you, well, however long you want. You can make it 5, 10 minutes, whatever. We use 5 minutes. And when we had in-person, parents' evening. It was technically a 5 minute slot, but you quickly time gets away from you. People are late for appointments. You never was sticking to your schedule. Well, I didn't when I was doing in-person parents' evening. But after 5 minutes, it cuts you off. And then the next parent or family will come in. So yeah, online parents' evening or just parents' evening in general, how should we be doing them? Something else we trialed last academic year was having a half day with parents' evening. And that was incredible. So we had the students in the morning and then everybody went home at lunchtime. And then their work was set online to do at home when we did parents' evening. Because when you think about parents' evening, let's just say you've got a teacher who's taught a full lesson, you know, six lessons, a full teacher timetable in one day. And then they've got back-to-back parents' evening appointments until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And that could be in the middle of the week. That is really not good for well-being. It's exhausting. So I do think we need to be very mindful of this. Yes, and we've got, I think it's Nathan Walker listening, says the timer is the best part, really helps with the process. And I completely agree. So in terms of online parents' evening and the benefits, the timer for me, yeah, that is the best part, because if your online schedule says that your last appointment is at 5:55, so you should be finished at 6 p.m., you absolutely will be finished at 6 p.m. because the timer will end the conversation and then you are done for the evening. But I'm sure lots of other teachers can relate to my experience where my last appointment is at 6, but I've ended up leaving at 6:30 or at 7 because conversations have overran 5 minutes, or parents have been late. Or another thing that happens when you're physically in person is a parent will say, "Oh, I didn't make an appointment, but could you just see me quickly?" And of course, we would never say no to that. But then the whole planning and scheduling just completely unravels, really. And we can end up staying at school really late. And then that's why I put another one of the reasons I like online parents' evening was the flexibility. So I can come home and let's just say I have gaps in between my sessions. You know, I can go to the toilet, I can have a drink, or I can have something to eat. And then when I'm done, when I'm finished, halas, we say here, when it's over, then that's it. I'm at home and I can relax. Whereas, you know, if you've got a half an hour journey and you're driving back 7:30 at night, and then by the time you get home. So that flexibility. But my school were very flexible where they said online parents' evening can be at home or it can be in school. Because some of my colleagues, one of my colleagues who's got children and a family, was very concerned about having parents' evening at home, because there's a lot going on in their home, background noise. So they appreciated the fact school was open, the Wi-Fi was there. And also technical support team were in school. So if you were not as confident, there was somebody on hand to help you. So I still dressed in professional attire. I wasn't in my, like I'm dressed now, in a tracksuit. I was still dressed professionally, but I was at home. And also, that just makes it seem a little bit more relaxed for everyone. It lowers the stakes. There's something about a parents' evening which can be quite nerve-wracking and formal. And from another perspective, the logistics as well. So in a school, you can have parents' evening where teachers are based in different classrooms and parents might not be familiar with the school and they may need a map, they may get lost. Some schools put all the teachers in the sports hall and have all the teachers in one place. But then the problem with that, and the problem I experience because I have a hearing impairment, is the noise and the acoustics. And having all the parents and all the students and teachers in one room, this was actually before I was wearing my hearing aid. So my hearing loss wasn't diagnosed at this point. And they were very close to me, but I was really struggling to hear. And obviously, that's really important that you're in an environment where everyone can hear each other. So we've got a few more comments coming in. Oh, brilliant. We have Dale listening on his 15-minute walk to school. Fantastic. Yes, it does help the process finish on time. I've been stuck at school before waiting to see parents at least 30 minutes after the end of the evening. I can relate to that, where I've got appointments that parents haven't turned up. I don't know if they're there or not. I'm waiting. Whereas if they miss their appointment, but this is a problem, and I will talk about the cons. If they miss their appointment online, that's sort of tough. So then the issue is, if you get emails saying, sorry, I missed the appointment, can I have a separate Zoom? Then we're looking at a separate work issue again. So we have Dale listening from Wolverhampton, who's walking to work. Love that. We have a comment, as a head of year, online parent evening is great as I can still make the calls that are built up in the day for my year group in between appointments. Really helps with the job list for the day after. After school events really eat into head of year tasks. Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that, because I'm a head of department. I mean, again, there's lots of pros and cons. There's been times as a head of department where this is in the past, where I'm usually sat with my teams, and if they had a question, I could always get involved and speak to the parents, which I can't do when that's online. I was told at a school meeting, I was told at a school that meetings were moved to be together in the hall, as staff felt intimidated alone in classrooms with parents. Yes, I understand that point as well. I've never been alone in a room with parents. I've always been in departments. So again, it's the how. It's how do we do parents' evening effectively in terms of timings? Should we not have a school day and have parents' evening then, but should we say, right, children learning from home, so we can have all our parents' consultation appointments, but then that could be very difficult for the parents and childcare. Because otherwise, like I've said, parents' evening is a really long, exhausting, challenging day. Do we do it online? Do we go back to in person? People have suggested a hybrid model. I'm really not sure how that would work. Saying, oh, sorry, I've got to go, someone is right here now. Maybe that would work, but again, I'm not sure. That would be interesting if anyone's done a hybrid model with it. The other thing that I do think, and I'm going to get to the pros and cons of parents' evening, but I do think parents should have some guidance about what will be discussed. Because obviously, if there are any major serious concerns, parents' evening is not the time really to talk about that, because they are short appointments where you see the parents and families of all your students. If there's a real concern, that should have been contacted separately, and nothing really should be a surprise on parents' evening if we have regular communication. But when I say guidance for parents, I think we all need to be on the same page about what we're talking about. I've had parents with a year seven student, and they've said to me, well, should my child study history at university? And I just pause for a moment, and I think, your child is in year seven. That is a conversation we have later down their schooling career. So asking me questions about what can you do with a history degree isn't appropriate in this meeting. We will have an options evening in year nine, and then an options evening in year 11. And we will have a careers advisor. There's some things that should be talked about in parents' evening, and then there are others that are not suitable. So I do think there should be a shared understanding of what the purpose of parents' evening is, what will be discussed, and perhaps what won't be discussed. And that everyone is very clear about that. So Tom Hopkins-Burker said he would rotate some years online, other year groups in person. Yes, also guidance about what to wear. Parents have turned up in, oh, nightwear. Oh, my goodness. Another one who answered the door while on the call to me. Oh, yes, this is the thing about online. Yeah, again, I totally agree. Yeah, I've heard all sorts of stories about, I'm not sure how to phrase this without sort of causing any offence. Basically, I've heard and read stories online about things that have happened in a home environment that are not suitable or appropriate. There's been arguments in the background. There's been the television on. There's been inappropriate dress wear. Yes, somebody has gone and answered the door and you're just sat waiting there. You know, where in their house is this happening? You know, they shouldn't obviously be lying in bed really with a laptop on their knee. You know, if preferable to sit, it might be on a sofa if they don't have a table. But yes, there should be sort of general guidelines and advice. So I'm going to go to the news, and then when we come back from the news, I'm going to talk about the pros and the cons, some of them that I've already explored, about online parents evening. So I'd love to hear more of your opinions and experiences. Please do share with me.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn. According to a report in the Guardian newspaper, black and minority ethnic girls in England are more than twice as likely to be excluded from school as their white counterparts. Agenda, an alliance of more than 50 charities campaigning for the most excluded women and girls, uncovered data following a Freedom of Information request to the Department of Education. This data showed that during the autumn term in both 2018 and 2019, black Caribbean girls were permanently excluded from school at double the rate of white British girls. Gypsy, Roma and traveller communities were four times more likely to face permanent exclusion than white British girls. A Department for Education spokesperson said, "We back head teachers to suspend or permanently exclude pupils where this helps maintain calm classrooms that bring out the best in every child. But this should only be used as a last resort. We expect staff to consider any underlying cause of poor behaviour before making this decision. We know children and young people from some backgrounds are more likely to be excluded. That is why we are working to deliver significantly improved outcomes for children and young people in alternative provision, who are most at risk of permanent exclusion." The Department for Education has announced the expansion of its Glasses in Classes scheme. It aims to provide two pairs of glasses, one for home and one for school, to more than 9,000 students in at least 225 schools in England. The scheme was piloted in Bradford and will now include Doncaster, Derby, Durham, Norwich and Breckland and the North Yorkshire coast. Students will also receive support from a vision coordinator under the scheme to ensure follow-up eye examinations are attended and glasses are worn regularly. Jeff Barton, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, said, "This novel scheme focuses on young people whose learning is hampered by poor eyesight and whose circumstances mean they have either not been to see an optician or do not have the glasses they need. It is refreshing to see the government reacting positively to a local initiative that has seen results in Bradford and extending it to a further five disadvantaged areas in the north of the country." This has been your daily education news briefing.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has three DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course, or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses. All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club.
Okay, thank you to Gail Glenn and to our wonderful Graham for reading the adverts. So the comments have been coming in about Parents' Evening. That's what we're talking about, not why we have Parents' Evening, because we've all agreed communication with family and communities is really important. It's the how and the when. When should they happen, in school hours or after hours? And the comments that have been coming in, because we've been discussing online Parents' Evening, which came about because of the pandemic and because we had to be socially distant and schools were closed. But actually, I do think that online Parents' Evening should stay. Not everyone is in agreement with me, and I do understand why. Jenny commented that they use phones, so it's just audio. What I'd be interested to know, Jenny, is do you do that in school on a school phone, just so that families don't have your personal number and obviously you don't get a high phone bill? And is there a timer for how long? I think some parents and families might miss seeing the teacher. And I think that is also with online Parents' Evening in general, that there is perhaps not the same connection. Someone else said they like seeing how children interact with their parents in their own environment. That's interesting too. Yeah, so there's lots and lots of positive points about online Parents' Evening. And as I've said, I've shared this article that I wrote for the TES about three reasons why Parents' Evening should stay. I said about the flexibility, in terms of I can do it at home, I don't have to drive home late, the car park isn't full and it's not a nightmare getting out in the evening. I also said about the timings, how online forces everyone to stick to timings, and just logistically as well. For me, I'm in a quiet place where I can hear and there's no distractions or disruption, unless that's happening perhaps on the other side. But of course, it's not perfect. Technical issues is the big one, and accessibility. As I've said, where I work, everyone has access to Wi-Fi and laptops, but you may work in an environment, in an area where perhaps parents have to do it on their phone. Perhaps they don't have a laptop. Perhaps they don't have the best Wi-Fi. And that obviously will be really challenging as well. The technical issues. I do have great Wi-Fi. So I rarely have technical issues, but I've had a few where it's froze and there's been a delay, and then that is a problem. But generally, I found doing it online, it was very easy and it wasn't very complex. And also, it is nice for parents and families to be in the school building where their students go to. So this is something that we will need to have a conversation about. When, well, lots of countries now, students are back in school. So do we bring the parents back in, or do we invite the parents for something else, another type of event that isn't Parents' Evening? There's lots and lots to think about. So Jenny said that she spoke to parents on the phone as audio. We were given the choice between a school phone or our own. I used my own mobile and did the 141 to withheld my number before dialing, blocked the number, no complaints from parents about it, and school staff loved it. Thank you, Jenny. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. A phone call home can serve absolutely that same purpose if it's about how their child is getting on. And that's also something else as well, is I mentioned about having this shared understanding of what will be spoken about. There are things, and I've experienced this as a form tutor, where I'm asked questions that I cannot answer. How is my child getting on in maths? Well, I don't know. Only their maths teacher could comment on that. And I'm not confident or comfortable discussing maths because I don't teach maths, just maths as an example. Or like I've said, asking questions that perhaps we think, well, we've got 5 minutes here. I gave the example of a year seven saying, should my child study history at university? What can you do with a history degree? And I said, well, this isn't the right time to have that. We will have that discussion many, many times throughout your child's time here at school. So these are all really interesting. In the article, I said that parents' evening is a little bit like the gym, that I sometimes dread it and think, oh, I've got parents' evening. But then when I'm actually there at the gym, it's never as bad as I think, and I end up enjoying it. I love having the conversations and meeting families. And just like the gym, we know why we do it. We know that it's important. So I can ask Bruce Robertson when he joins us what he thinks about parents' evening. And if you do have any questions for Bruce, then do let me know. So to just give you a little bit of background, his books, The Teacher Delusion, are really, really good. And I have been very fortunate to read Teacher Delusions 3 because I wrote the foreword to it. And yes, the focus of The Teacher Delusion, they are teaching and learning books, which I suppose it makes sense to ask me to write the foreword because I love writing and reading about teaching and learning. So please do send any of your questions to me about teaching and learning in general. The books just cover so much. There's cognitive science for teaching and learning. There's feedback for teachers. All of these things I will be asking Bruce about. Apologies, there was some background noise there. But this is the interesting thing as well about wherever. So I'm currently just in my living room in my apartment. And the reason I used to host the Love to Teach podcast, and I don't do that anymore. It was a very short 20-minute podcast. There are 10 episodes that are still available if you would like to listen. I much prefer Teachers Talk Radio, and I like the live element about it. Oh, we're there. We have a caller. I think this might be Bruce. Hello? And I'll come back to my point about Love to Teach podcast. Oh, not there. Let's see. Oh, hello. Is this Bruce?
Hi, morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah. That was a hard bit joining. It's all easy from now.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah. There we go. And thank you. I know that you're in school and you've got meetings and you've just managed to sort of squeeze me into your busy day, in your busy morning. So I'm very, very happy
to do that. I'm all coffeed up and good to go.
Oh, good. Well, I always start off with a fun fact. And my fun fact about you is that you and I, so I'm in your book, Teaching Delusion 3, and you're in my new book as well. So
love that.
I love that too. And I suppose another fun fact is that we have a mutual friend who wrote the foreword to your books. Mm. Did Robin write the foreword to two of your trilogies? Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, Robin wrote the foreword to the first Teaching Delusion book. It's a wonderful foreword that he wrote. He's written the foreword to the second book as well. And I'm delighted, Kate, that you've written the foreword to the third book. There are three wonderful forewords.
Oh, well, I loved your book. And Robin McPherson wrote the foreword to Love to Teach. So we've got that in common. And then obviously, yes, I've written this book with Robin and we were both very keen to include you in the book because we're massive fans of your books.
Oh,
so are they out? Yeah. Are they out now, your books?
Today's the launch day. They come out today.
Oh, that is perfect timing, isn't it?
Yeah, the Teaching Delusion becomes a trilogy as of today.
Okay, then. So for actually, we'll get to your career, but just because you and I are mentioning the Teaching Delusion, mm-hmm. for anyone who's listening, can you just sort of explain what you mean by that? Because you've called all of your books the Teaching Delusion.
Oh, yeah.
So what, and then obviously they've got the different like Strikes Back and so on, but what's the sort of the premise behind what is the Teaching Delusion?
Okay, I'll give you the long answer. So I've been leading work on teaching and learning in a school in the Scottish Borders over a number of years. And the work that we were doing, people were starting to talk about that in other schools. I was getting requests to come and visit. One of the key things we developed was called a lesson evaluation toolkit. And it was really just a structured framework to support reflection on lessons in planning or after a lesson has been taught. It was a coaching tool, really. And people really seemed to like that. So I thought that I would start to write about that. And then that started to become a book. And I was going to call the book Lesson Evaluation Toolkit. And then I thought, well, it's a bit dry. So I considered other titles. And I was going to go with Towards Great Teaching. That was the working title. I quite liked that, Towards Great Teaching. And then I ran it by one of my friends. And he just said, yawn. And I was quite taken aback by that because I thought it was quite a good title. And he's like, no, that's really dull. He's like, nobody's going to want to read that. I'm like, okay. And he said, so come on, let's come up with a better title. What's the book about? And we started to talk about that. And as part of the conversation, I said, well, often things aren't quite as good as we think they are for one reason or another. And he said, just a bit cheekily, so people can be a bit deluded. And I said, oh, teaching delusion, there's an idea. And that's what we went with. I ran it by the publisher. The publisher liked it. I ran it by a few people. They liked it. So that's what we went with, the teaching delusion. The subtitle of the first book is Why Teaching in Our Schools Isn't Good Enough and How We Can Make It Better. And if you've read the book, which I know you have, Kate, I'm not saying teaching isn't good enough in a negative way. The whole premise to the book is that things can just never be good enough. We need this mindset of continuous improvement. That's the key mindset. And we need to all just work together to keep making our teaching better and better and better. And that's the exciting part of the job. So that's really what I mean by it in the first book.
Yeah, I remember seeing that and thinking, ooh. But then actually anyone who reads your books will have a few moments where they go, oh, this thing doesn't hold back. He goes for it.
in a good way. Yeah, it's meant to be supportive. I think you need these moments where you're like, okay, right, I'll just stop and I'll just think about that and I'll consider it. And I might agree, I might not. But the whole thing is about making people think. You know, I say it quite a few times throughout the trilogy. I think it really comes from people like Rob Coe, Daniel William, you know, that learning will typically happen when people think hard about specific things. So I'm hoping that within the books, the way that they're written, they will encourage people to just pause for reflection and think, well, does that apply to me? Do I agree with that? Do I disagree? So that's part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved your books and can't believe how much you cover breadth and depth, and it did definitely make me think and stop. And I do like that your style always sort of comes across, and now people listening, they will, when they're reading the book, they will hear your voice through it, which will be great.
Of the feedback I've had from friends actually and colleagues. They've said that and I like this, they've said that as they read it, they can hear me talking. So I like that there's an authenticity to that, I think.
Yeah, I really got a good sense of your character and personality as well as your experiences. So
great.
I that is really brilliant and authentic, because as I said, you're still in a school, aren't you? Is it correct? So you were a senior leader?
Yeah, I'm head teacher. Yep.
Oh, head teacher. Sorry, I thought you were. Are you a rector or head teacher?
The official title is rector, but it's one in the same. It's just the history of the school that I'm the head teacher of, Berwickshire High School. The position has always been rector, so that's why that exists. And I think history is important within a community. Berwickshire High School's in a small town in the southeast of Scotland, the Scottish Borders in Duns, I started as the head teacher last August. The school's actually in the equivalent of special measures. So we've been working over the last year to really turn things around, and we've been having a lot of success with that. I'm really, really happy with where we are as a school. When I wrote the first book, I wasn't in this position. I had been deputy head teacher in Eyemouth High School, which is also in the Scottish Borders. And then I did a year's secondment as a development officer working with schools to support them to develop teaching and learning. So when the first book came out, that's what I was doing. And now, as I say, yeah, head teacher.
And science teacher background, is that
correct? Yeah, chemistry teacher, that's right, yeah. I started teaching in 2003. I've always been in the southeast of Scotland, East Lothian and the Scottish Borders. I grew up in a small village called Coldingham and went to Eyemouth High School as a student, so it was a great honour and privilege to go back to that school as the deputy head. And now I'm about 20 miles away from there in Berwickshire High School as the head.
Oh, wow. And for me, that's so important. I always say this as well, about it really does come from the top in terms of creating this vision and this culture with teaching and learning. So the fact that you're writing about the real sort of nitty gritty bits of lessons, that's so important. So we've talked about, well, you mentioned about your first book. So did you just feel like, oh, I've got a lot more to say, and that's why you wrote your follow-up books?
You'll know this yourself, Kate.
It's
actually a lot more work than you think to write a book. You read the book and you think, oh, well, that just must have been written in that order, in that way. But it's not the case. It's really quite difficult synthesizing, pulling together all the different parts. And there's maybe as much discarded as is actually included. So when I got towards the end of the first book, which I think it took almost 2 years on and off to write, I thought that was it. I thought, everybody's got a book in them, and that's my book. And I was very happy with what I'd said in the book. And then within, about a month, I started to think, actually, I could have said a little bit more about that, or actually, maybe my thinking on that has just evolved a little bit. I'll maybe just start to jot down a few ideas. And I got in touch with Alex Sherratt at John Catt Publishing, and I said, maybe I'd like to write a follow-up, just something short, maybe in the region of 12 to 20,000 words maximum. And Alex was up for that. And then before I knew it, it became 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, and then 100,000 words. And it was about that point that I realized I hadn't actually written one book, but it was two. And there was a real natural split within the book. A section which was going to form the middle of the book actually in the end didn't end up fitting particularly well there. It was its own book. So that became Power Up Your Pedagogy, which is book three.
Yeah, and I absolutely love that. So yeah, I do know what it's like to write a book and then still have more to say. And I think that's great that you have, I like the trilogy. Is that also because Bobby said you're a massive Star Wars fan as well? I think you said that.
No, that's not entirely true.
Isn't it? No, it strikes back. Is that not like a hat tip to Star Wars? No.
That's definitely where it comes from. Absolutely. Yeah. It's The Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, the nod to that. But I'm not a massive Star Wars fan, if I'm being honest. But I thought people get that reference. That's well known. So I have this thing where the covers are all to do with the universe, and it's to do with the quote that appears at the start of the first book. It's a Carl Sagan quote. So that's why the universe appears on the cover of the first book. And then I really liked it. I loved the cover for the first book. So I asked my publisher if we could continue with that theme. So that kind of links a bit to Star Wars as well.
Well, how it came up was because, see, I've never seen a Star Wars film ever, but I understand that reference about Strikes Back, and I understand some references. But Robin put quite a few Star Wars references in our book, and there was some that I didn't understand. And I wrote on the comments, what is this? Like, I don't get it. And then he ended up saying, well, Bruce likes Star Wars as well. I was like, okay, but... So really random. But yeah, I love, obviously, yeah, I wrote the foreword to the Teaching Delusion theme. Power Up Your Pedagogy. Absolutely fantastic, as all your books are. And Well, there's a few things I wanted to pick up on that, but when I revisited it again ahead of our conversation, and then it said about burning bright, and I really like that because I feel like I'm trying to strip back things, otherwise I'm going to burn out. And I think it's that idea, isn't it, as well, about, as you've said, about teachers shining and burning brightly in contrast to burning out. So that just resonated with me. I thought, oh, I need to be careful here. I'm going to burn out instead of burn bright. And then the other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about as well was I really liked, you obviously write about feedback that teachers get as well, about how it can be very poor. And I've had this in my career that hasn't really helped me, but it's sort of ticked a box. Or it could be very powerful to power their pedagogy to help them become better teachers. So could you give us some examples? Well, first of all, and I think it does help to talk about examples of poor feedback for people who do give feedback, perhaps they're mentoring, line managers. What are examples of poor feedback to give to teachers?
Yeah, so in the first book, that's one of the things that I really do get into. When I'm saying that teaching in our schools isn't good enough, as I've said, part of it is because, well, it can just be never, it can never be good enough. We need that mindset of continuous improvement. But another key reason is because often teachers who are wanting to get better and better with their teaching practice, well, they're held back because the feedback that they're getting from school leaders, say, isn't particularly useful to them. At its worst, it actually sends them off in the wrong direction or confuses them. So I feel quite strongly that there's a responsibility on everyone who works in a school and with teachers to continuously upskill themselves in terms of their professional knowledge and understanding of what will typically make great teaching. I'm thinking about the sort of feedback where, well, number one, where a document is handed over to a teacher or emailed to a teacher, and the person's like, well, there you go. There's your feedback. And that's probably the worst example. It doesn't even matter what it says. That's no way to give feedback to somebody. I actually say towards the end of the Teaching Delusion 3 that I don't particularly like the term feedback when it comes to sitting down with teachers and having a conversation about a lesson. That's just the nature of words sometimes. But the feedback term itself suggests that somebody is going to be saying, well, I like this and I think this worked well, but I think this didn't work well, or I think you need to work on that. And I don't think that that's powerful. I think it's far better that we're getting into a conversation, that it's about coaching. That is helped if there's a common point of reference. So in the first book, for example, the lesson evaluation toolkit that's talked about, when we do lesson observations in Berwickshire High School, we will always be referring to this lesson evaluation toolkit. If I've observed a teacher after I've thanked them at the end of the lesson, I'll always say, could you complete a self-evaluation using our lesson evaluation toolkit? And we'll sit down in a day or two and we'll have a chat about the lesson. So what the teacher's done is they've systematically thought about the lesson using a structured framework. And then I've done the same thing. And then I'll say, okay, so what would you like to talk about? And they'll pick something and we'll get into a conversation about that. And in part, the quality of the conversation will come from how much the teacher and myself actually understand about pedagogy. So that's where professional reading becomes so important. We need to keep upskilling ourselves. So conversation for me is absolutely essential. But if we got into the specific feedback itself, too often I hear examples of teachers being told, you need to talk less. Students need to lead their learning more. There wasn't enough higher order thinking. There wasn't enough creativity. You need to differentiate more. Now, I think that's unhelpful for a number of reasons. The first is that often these phrases are just too vague and they're just too open to interpretation. What does that actually mean? And sometimes this feedback isn't actually valuable in that it might not be accurate. There is an idea in some schools that student-led learning is the be-all and the end-all. And I argue in my books that there's absolutely a place for student-led learning, but it typically will come at a particular point in a learning sequence. As students are developing from novice towards expert, I'm arguing quite strongly that in the novice stages, we need more teacher-led approaches. We use evidence of learning to guide the teaching, so the teaching's responsive in that way, but it needs to be more teacher-led in the earlier stages of any learning sequence. And then as students become more and more expert, well, that's when they're in a better position to lead their learning more. So that's what I'm really trying to get at in terms of feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got comments in the chat, agree. A tweet to me saying about they're nodding their head along in agreement, and me too as well. Because I wanted to ask you about this, I've got a folder from my previous school with lesson observation templates and feedback.
Yeah.
And genuinely, one of my targets, or, well, it was just saying, how could this lesson have been better? And the class arrived late to my lesson, and I should make sure they arrive on time. And they just come from PE. And how is that? That is completely out of my control if they are late from one lesson to another. I can't go to, when I'm teaching, I can't go physically collect them from another room. And how does that help me as a teacher? But there's been other times in my career where people have said, you know what, I have to give you targets. I'm just going to say this. And it just becomes so pointless then.
It's demoralizing, really.
Yeah, it really is.
Something that should just be seen as so valuable, the opportunity to sit down with another professional and talk about pedagogy, talk about teaching, talk about learning. It just should be so exciting. But the example that you're giving, you know, there will be so many people just nodding their heads because just about everybody's had an experience like that. You need to smile more. You need to tidy up your room, stuff like that. Well, maybe. Maybe not. That's subjective, and it's verging on personal. Actually, sometimes let's really focus it on the teaching and the learning. And I do think that sometimes people end up receiving feedback like that because the person who's giving the feedback doesn't actually have anything more constructive to say. And the reason they don't have anything more constructive to say is because there's actually a gap in their own understanding about what makes high quality teaching and learning. So they're grasping at straws and they pick something. And that's, I keep coming back to the point, it's why it's so important that all of us keep upskilling themselves. And I would always like to think that the discussion that I get into a teacher in 6 months' time, say, that will be even better than the discussion I would get into them with them now, because my own understanding keeps developing through reading and reflection.
Yeah, absolutely. And also as well, I suppose it works both ways because I was having a conversation after I was in a lesson and I was sat next to a student and the teacher had praised an answer on a mini whiteboard and was just saying how brilliant this response was. But the student next to me and we couldn't see what was on the mini whiteboard. We were like, oh, I wonder what it is, you know, and that was all I said to the teacher was, you know what, I was really intrigued. I would have loved it for you to, you praised the answer and it was brilliant. So for anyone who couldn't have seen that, because I think they were on the front row, so anyone behind them, that would have been really good if you'd have read it out and shared it. Mm-hmm. And I remember he got very, very defensive with me about that. And so it works both ways, doesn't it? That the person giving the feedback has to obviously, as you said, be informed and it genuinely has to be helpful. And then receiving the feedback, you have to have the attitude that you want to learn and progress, not that you're the finished article and that you're done. So it's a tricky
one. That's right. It is tricky. No, you're absolutely right. We're talking about two key things here. We're talking about the way that the feedback's given, and I'm suggesting that it should never be by an email or a piece of paper handed over with no discussion. And then we're talking about what the feedback actually is. And the reason I think that something like a lesson evaluation toolkit from the first book is so powerful is because it can help teachers come to their own conclusions. They're thinking about statements in a common framework and they've arrived at their own conclusions. People like Dylan William, I've heard him say that really what we're trying to do is to do ourselves out of a job. That we were trying to empower our teachers so that use of a structured self-evaluation tool like that leads them to their own conclusions. So the role of the person who'd been observing the lesson becomes minimal. They're just nudging in the right direction. The fact that there's going to be a conversation, well, that really gives the teacher the push to think about the lesson in that way. But often there doesn't need to be too much of a push coming from the person who observed the lesson in terms of any specifics. It's softer than that.
Yeah, and I've spoken about this with lots of people, my guests, Dame Alison Peacock, Professor Daniel Mears, head of research at Ofsted previously. Graded lesson observations are still happening, and I know how you feel about that, but again, yeah, that brings in a whole host of issues and problems. Are they happening in Scotland in some schools, or do you think Scotland have moved
not
away?
No, graded lesson observations, I'm not aware of that happening anywhere, which is a good thing. Absolutely, yeah. That's a good thing. I think we have done away with that. I think more of the issue probably is the quality of the discussion, like we're talking about here. Too much of a focus on these vague phrases that we were talking about, or too much on a focus on things that might overall be useful, like students leading their learning, but not really getting into the specifics of what we mean by that. So it's more about the quality of the discussions, I would suggest. That's a bigger issue.
Yeah, and you mentioned Daniel Willingham. He's our guest next week on my show, which I'm so excited about. And throughout your book, there's lots of references to, it's really clear that you're widely read, lots of references to cognitive science. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I've written very specifically about retrieval practice, but you've written about lots of different elements of cognitive science. So in terms of cognitive science and the impact it's had on your teaching practice, is there anything specifically, any of the principles that you think, how has this changed how you teach? And I suppose what you're looking at with lessons as well, because we know that learning happens over time.
Yeah.
So we have to consider that when we're going into a lesson. So yeah, cognitive science principles and your teaching.
So I was presenting to newly qualified teachers in the Scottish Borders yesterday. My presentation was called Pedagogical Principles, which is something I discuss in the second book. And as part of it, I had a quote from Craig Barton's How I Wish I'd Taught Maths. I'm just paraphrasing here, but it's the quote which is, teachers who don't really understand how students learn are a bit like doctors who only have a casual interest in how the human body works, or bakers in the same way with the best conditions to make bread. And I was saying to the newly qualified teachers yesterday that until a few years ago, I was definitely like the doctor, the baker referred to here. That if you'd asked me, well, what is learning? Well, I'd be talking about knowing something new or being able to do something new. When I ask that question to teachers, if I'm leading some professional development with them and they write something on a show me board, well, that's typically what I'll see, something about new. And that, of course, is right. That's what learning is ultimately, but how does it happen? And that's what I'd never really considered until a few years ago. And that's where the cognitive science becomes so important. So that relationship between working memory and long-term memory, that the principle of learning happening when we think hard about specific things, and probably the most useful out of all of it, the testing effect, and this idea that the act of retrieving content, information, knowledge from long-term memory, that strengthens the memory of it, which of course links to all of your work, Kate, on retrieval practice. So it's that really, it's the power of the testing effect. And when I'm presenting to teachers, I'll often start the session by saying, well, just give me a 1 to 10 on where you feel your professional knowledge and understanding is on this. And one of the things would be the testing effect. And usually people on the testing effect will be 0, 1. And that's helpful to know when you're starting the session off. And then by the end of it, there's a real change and you can see a buzz in people and a penny starting to drop. And having that understanding about learning and how it works in a cognitive sense, I think that really does help you when you're thinking about a lesson as a teacher or when you're observing the lesson. Because now you're considering to what extent are the activities in the lesson supporting students to think hard about specific content? That's what I'm always thinking about when I'm in a lesson. What is it most likely that students are thinking about here? How hard are they thinking? Are we getting evidence of the thinking of one or two, or the thinking of everyone? And it's that really that has really influenced me.
Yeah, I learned a lot from your books. I may naturally my bias. I love the cognitive science lectures, but I do get frustrated with some teachers who say, oh yeah, but we've always done this and we've always known this. No, like the knowledge that we have about cognitive science and psychology, yes, I think there's an element of truth in that we've had quizzes in our lessons that have mm-hmm. been low stakes. But this understanding of memory and harnessing the benefits of the testing effect, I'm like you, I didn't know this when I started teaching. I didn't think about, and to say that out loud, that we didn't think mm-hmm. about memory when we're teaching information to students and knowledge and skills, that is quite shocking, really. And,
well, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, it is a surprise. So there's still so much to learn, hence us writing more books. I could probably write another book about retrieval practice yeah. because I've done even more research and I've had more conversations and more research has been published.
Yeah.
So to have this attitude that we've always done this, mm-hmm. it's just not true. You know, or yeah, if they did, right. I think, yeah. And that's what you're about, I suppose, why the message of teaching why it isn't good enough, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I talk about a teaching learning gap and how that will always exist, at least initially. There will be a gap between what is taught and what is learned, because covering content and students learning content, they're not the same thing. And typically there's three reasons, I think, why we end up with a teaching learning gap. One is that students are not paying attention. And that's not necessarily to do with poor behavior in the class. It may be, but it's often to do with how the content is being presented. The structure of PowerPoint slides, for example. What are we actually drawing students' attention to? Is their attention being split, for example? So not paying attention is one. Not understanding is two. But then the third is forgetting, which is entirely natural, biological. We just have to accept that that is going to happen. And then we have to do things to guard against forgetting. And the two things that I'm really pushing for in this series, or retrieval practice and spaced practice.
Yeah.
And I was suggesting to the newly qualified teachers yesterday that it doesn't matter how good the presentation is that you give to a class. It doesn't matter if you have 100% of students paying attention 100%. The fact is, there is still going to be forgetting. You shouldn't take that as a criticism of the quality of your teaching. It's natural. So what we need to do is we need to accept that point, and then we need to do things to guard against the forgetting. And so I was suggesting to them that the presentation I was giving yesterday, that would not be enough in itself for their learning on the topics that I was covering. There would have to be follow-up. There would have to be revisiting, preferably using retrieval practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you've mentioned about how things can be demoralizing. Well, when we have that awareness that forgetting will happen and we accept it and we prepare for it, then it's not as demoralizing when students forget that, because yeah. we have a completely different approach to it. And that's, and as I said, we prepare for it because we harness the benefits of the testing effect and retrieval practice.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, the end of the lesson, you do an exit ticket and you find out that there's good evidence that students understood what you were talking about in that lesson. So you've got that evidence of short-term performance. And then 3 days later, the class comes back and you're so demoralized that actually half the class no longer know anything about what you were talking about. And you might think, well, that reflects poorly on your teaching, or you might blame the students for that. But what you and I are both saying, I think, is that's entirely natural. It's biological. So let's build into our planning opportunities to do something about that retrieval practice in a spaced way.
Yeah, and something that I thought was interesting, reading your book, and it was interesting because I think I was writing and editing my book, and there was one or two points I thought, oh, this is interesting to hear your perspective about it, because we both have written about learning intentions and that we're advocates for them, because some people hear lesson objectives and they think absolute waste of time, mm-hmm. but we're both for them, but we recognize that they've been mutated, copied mm-hmm. out, glued into books, absolute yeah. waste of time. So this is just a quote from your book that I wrote down. My own view is that the more specific a learning intention is to a particular lesson, the more useful it is. And I wrote that a learning intention can span more than one lesson and that it shouldn't focus on a specific lesson. Although I understand what you're saying. And I was trying to figure out, do we agree or do we have a disagreement about learning intentions? Because okay, let me phrase it like this to you. What if you don't finish what you intended to do? Could the same learning intention just span over to next lesson? Or do you think it should
definitely.
Be?
Definitely.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
I think we agree. Yeah, I think
we agree.
Do.
I thought
yeah.
so. I just
It's another great example of why the conversation is so important, because imagine if you'd just yeah. given me written feedback based on that and then we never talked
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
What we actually understand is that there is agreement here. What I'm suggesting is that if the learning intention is vague, and that will usually come about because the teacher is not clear in their own mind what it is that they want students to learn in this particular lesson or series of lessons, that in itself will lead to a vague learning intention, which will lead to vague success criteria, which will lead to a lack of focus in the lesson. I talk in one of the books about an example of a lesson where the teacher wanted students to learn about tourist attractions along the River Nile. And what the teacher did was he gave the class some information, a series of statements about tourist attractions, and then a series of starter sentences, and asked them to use those two things to make a tourist information leaflet, which summarized information about destinations along the River Nile. And that took most of the lesson. And then they did an exit ticket at the end of the lesson. And a good number of students, when they'd been asked, well, what did you learn in this lesson? They'd written, the River Nile looks like a tree. And there was an image of the Nile up on the screen. And absolutely in this image, the River Nile looked like a tree. And I don't believe that the students were being cheeky at all. I believe that that's the learning that came from the lesson. And there'd been a real lack of focus just through the tasks. Getting back to this idea, what are the tasks getting students to think about specifically? Well, they weren't thinking hard enough about specific content. I don't think the teacher in this particular lesson was clear enough in their own mind about what it was they wanted the students to leave having learned. So there was a vague learning intention which led to tasks that weren't particularly focused on that learning. And then, as we saw evidenced in the exit ticket, students were walking away with nothing really of significance having changed. So that's my point, really, that we need to be more specific in the learning intention. So I give examples in Power Up Your Pedagogy. I think the third section of the book goes into learning intentions in some detail and gives examples. So it might say something like, we are learning about the structure of the atom specifically to bang. Whatever it is specifically in that lesson. So you've got a more overarching statement, which is spanning a number of lessons. We're learning about the structure of the atom, specifically, bang, it gives the example. Now, I think that's helpful to become more specific in the lesson. It gives it more focus. But your point, Kate, is really, well, what if through the course of the lesson, you really don't think that learning intention has been achieved? Am I suggesting that you shouldn't then continue with that learning intention the next day? Absolutely not. I'm not suggesting that. You definitely should. It would be, I think, pretty poor teaching not to, because you've got evidence from your interaction with your students that what you were setting out to achieve hasn't been achieved. So why would you just move on? You need to focus on that particular learning intention. So it's maybe the idea of a lesson that's the key point here. I'm more than happy for a lesson to span more than one period, if you like.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I got that. And actually, that was really interesting because I found that the challenging most challenging chapter of my formative assessment book to write was Learning Intentions, but I ended up thinking it was the most important and needed. Yeah. So I really enjoyed reading what you wrote about that as well.
I heard you talking with Dylan William about that. Sorry to interrupt you, but you were talking about that last week. Yeah, and you were talking about that very idea that it's the first strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But the most difficult.
Yeah.
I think in Scottish education, certainly, since I started 20 years ago, schools were trying to get to grips with learning intentions then. And they're still trying to get to grips with learning intentions now. And I think we've made it far more complicated than it needs to be. And I think there's a lot of mutated ideas, as you were suggesting, come out. We need to strip it back, and we just need to make it much simpler. What are we learning specifically in this lesson? And that's it. And just frame it in language that students can understand. And I think I give examples of that in Power Up Your Pedagogy.
Yeah, there's loads of examples throughout your book. I think your book would be really good for an educational book club. Lots of schools are having book clubs where they'll, you know, take away a chapter and then discuss it later. And I love that because... And even we do that with TV shows like Line of Duty, things like that. We like to talk about things that we've enjoyed, that we've learned from. It's good to talk about it with other people.
Yeah.
There's actually been a discussion on Twitter about the point of CPD libraries and should schools even have them. And I'm a big advocate for them, even though I have my own books. So what do you think about a staff CPD library? Is this something that you promote, or do you just think actually teachers, we've got an obligation to do it ourselves and have our own books? I'm not sure.
I'm a big advocate of CPD or professional learning libraries. I'm pretty sure that IMF High School, when I was leading teaching and learning as deputy there, I'm pretty sure it was one of the first schools in Scotland to set one up. And we promoted that, shared that on Twitter. And we've seen them popping up all over the place now.
I'm
such a fan. It's such a signal to the staff who work in a school that we are investing in you.
Yes.
Your professional development, that really matters to us, because through an investment in our staff, we are investing in our students. We spend a reasonable amount of money every few months updating the professional learning library in Berwickshire High School. Often we're going to John Catt publications because they're just such high quality. But it's always being updated. I don't think it's right, actually, that we expect teachers to have to invest in their own professional development. Teachers give enough as it is. Many will choose to do that, absolutely. But we should be investing in our staff to invest in our students.
I absolutely agree with you. And whilst I do have my own books, I think it's what it, as you've said, the CPD library represents as well.
Yeah.
And the choice of books out there, that does help teachers financially if the staff CPD library does have it, because the comments were that there's some staff CPD libraries where all the books are still there, untouched.
Yeah.
So then that comes down to creating the culture, asking. And the previous school I was at, they didn't have a CPD library, and I sort of badgered SLT to get one. And when the books came, I was so disappointed. They were just, someone had typed in education into Amazon.
Yeah.
But all of these books that I hadn't even heard of, they were really old. And I said, why didn't you ask me? I've read a lot. I could have recommended books that I've read and books I want to read.
I'll tweet a picture later, Kate, of the Berwickshire High School Professional Learning Library. I've not set it up. It's staff in our school who've set it up, but I'm so proud of it. It's a fantastic resource for staff. I'll tweet it later. But when I started as the head teacher a year or so ago, there had been something set up, but really tokenistic. It was stuffed away at the back of a reprographics room. You say, it just had a load of books that were really old that had something loosely to do with education, but who was going to want to invest time in reading those books? We set up a dedicated room with a coffee machine, We've set up a display whereby the covers are photocopied and staff can write key learning points on post-it notes and stick it up. We have posters from Impact Wales up, which are fantastic.
Yeah.
It's just a dedicated professional learning space for staff. And then you need other things that go along with it, because some staff will just dip in and out themselves, but we've got a professional reading group, and that meets every fortnight. So they've got a common text, and it actually meets twice. It meets during the school day at a lunchtime. Some staff like to do that. There's actually a less formal version of the group, I believe, which meets in the evening. Some staff want to do that. They want to get home for childcare reasons or whatever, and they would prefer to meet at 8 o'clock in the evening over a glass of wine, and they do that on some online platform. Now, not everybody will want to do that. Some people will want to walk away from school, and then that's it. That's the working day over. Different people are different. So it's about creating the conditions, as you say, to support your staff to engage in professional reading and discussion.
Well, you've read lots of the same books that I have, and we're both Dylan William fans, so we'll have to have a glass of wine over Zoom and talk about all of these books. And I know you've got to go soon, but I ask lots of people about what their future plans are, but I don't know how to phrase this, but I think you look young, and I'm always interested when head teachers are quite young, like Robin. He'll be happy that I say Robin McPherson looks young. And when you're a young head teacher, where do you go next after that? That's just me. That's just a curious question that I have, because we do have quite a few years ago, it was sort of this very traditional model, which Robin and I have written about, that things have changed now. Mm-hmm. But then when you do have head teachers like yourself who are young and still very keen and enthusiastic, mm-hmm. do you plan to stay in that same role? Do you branch out? Like what do you see for your, perhaps you haven't, because you're quite new to this role, so perhaps you do plan to stay there long term, but what are your future plans in terms of education, and is there any more books?
So I love the school that I'm the head teacher of. It's really, really special to me for a number of reasons. I'm really, really proud of the school which I'm the head teacher of. I certainly plan to remain as head teacher in this school for some time to come. It's a wonderful job to be head teacher. It's really the key position where you can influence culture in a school. Yeah. And the strength of the professional learning culture that we've been building in the school over the past 12 months. I'm just really, really pleased and excited with where we're going as a school. Longer term, well, I'm really interested in influence. I'm really interested in how I can influence schools and support teachers to make teaching and learning better and better and better. And whatever role allows me to do that the most effectively, well, that's the sort of role that I'm really interested in. In terms of books, as I suggested at the start, it was an awful lot of work, a lot more work than I thought it would be to write the first book, and I didn't think I was going to write any more, and then I did, and I really, really enjoyed it. But yeah, it was a lot of work. I think I'm going to pause on the books for a short period of time. It's a trilogy now, Kate, so I can't write a fourth Teaching Delusion book. That would destroy the trilogy.
Well, I wrote 3 retrieval practice books, and I said I wouldn't do any more, but you never know. Yeah. So, or maybe you just have a new trilogy, but I know what you mean about taking a pause. I can't take a pause just yet because I've got one more book, but after that, I want to take a pause, because you give everything to it, mm-hmm. And actually, you've got to enjoy now your books going out there. Teachers, listeners, go order the book and tweet a photo of it and share your thoughts.
Definitely. I'd love it if people did that. I love to hear what people think of the books. I love it when they'll pick a favourite quote, just a line from the book, something that really resonates. I absolutely love that. I love getting into schools and working with teachers. I was able to go up to Fort William a couple of weeks ago and do some professional development work with staff up there, and it's the first time I've been able to do that in about 18 months, and I absolutely loved doing that to work with teachers in that way. So moving forward, I really would like to be doing more of that, maybe offering some sessions in evenings or weekends for teachers. Focusing on some of the ideas that are in the Teaching Delusion series.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to hear you talking about it. And there's so much, actually. There's so much from your book that I could just have picked up on and asked you more questions about. And I know, you know, you'll probably be on more podcasts. Darren Leslie's a big fan. He wants you back on his podcast.
Yeah, so Darren and I used to work together. I don't know if you know that, Kate.
No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Darren was a newly qualified teacher in Eyemouth High School as I started as the deputy head. So that's where I first met Darren. So it's really, really interesting how our careers have progressed.
Yeah, because he interviewed me recently and was just, he didn't say that he worked with you, but he was off, well, in the interview and off sort of off record, off recording, he was saying how brilliant you are. And he was just saying how you're like one of the best in Scotland. And Marvin says that as well, like your profile in Scotland and the community in Scotland are really learning a lot from you, but not just Scotland now because you've got your books. So we can all benefit here in Abu Dhabi. Yeah. I will always be a little bit late to the party in terms of books because I'm in Abu Dhabi, but I will tweet a photo as soon as it arrives because I obviously read the manuscript, so I can't wait to get a hard copy. It's on its way.
I'm sorry you can't make the launch party tomorrow.
I know, yeah, when you invited me and I was like, oh, sorry, that's a little bit too far for me. So where's that happening?
It's a good excuse, I would suggest. It's happening in Edinburgh tomorrow night. We're having a party. As it turned out, the last time that I really got together with family and friends was at the launch for the first book, which was on the 6th of March 2020. And then, as we all know, of course, within a week or two, we went into lockdown. So this is the first real opportunity since then for family and friends to get together. So we're meeting in a place called the Devil's Cut in Edinburgh. We've got some talks, some signing. We've got a DJ. It's going to be a good night.
Oh, amazing. And will you have a wee dram? Did I get that right?
A wee dram, absolutely. Yeah, maybe two.
One or two wee drams. I think Robin or Mark Healy told me about that. Oh, well, when I am back in the UK, I'll come up to Scotland because I've got lots of friends there, you, Darren, Robin. But the feedback already for people who've read your books, I mean, Carl Hendrick, Tom Sherrington, all these amazing comments and reviews are coming in and it's been doing really well on Amazon. So the next few weeks are going to be really, really exciting when the book lands in people's hands and then they'll be giving you all that feedback. So enjoy that. Very well deserved.
Thanks so much, Kate. Thanks for having me on today. I've loved that.
Yeah, and me too. I wanted to talk to you. We'll make sure that we talk again. Yeah. So I'll let you go because I think you've got a meeting.
Yeah, staff meeting coming up. That's right.
That you've got to lead. Busy rector in Scotland. But thank you again. And I will tweet out links for all of our listeners to follow you on Twitter and where they can get your books. And also for book clubs, they should contact Alex Sharrett at John Cat because he does do discounts on bulk orders. So your book would be one that would be fantastic. Lots to sort of get into and talk about. So I'll share that as well.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge, and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course, or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses. All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teachersLoveStationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club.
Oh, wow. I absolutely loved chatting to Bruce Robinson, and I genuinely love his book, The Teaching Delusion. And I agreed to write the foreword before I'd even read it because I'd read his previous book, and I knew it would just be so fantastic. It is grounded in research and lots of references, which will sort of lead you to go off and read more things. But there's lots of experiences and examples, and it's just so knowledgeable and very refreshingly honest. So I honestly cannot recommend that book highly enough. And lots of teachers have said to me, okay, I've read your books and I really enjoyed them. What other books, teaching and learning wise, would you suggest? And I always say The Teaching Delusion, because it's really, really good. So thank you to Bruce. And as I said, his books are out now, which is very exciting. And he's on Twitter at TTDelusion. So do follow Bruce, head teacher at Berwickshire High School in Scotland. He's also got a great blog, theteachingdelusion.com. He's got some really great posts on there about working memory, feedback. Do check that out. I really like it. Okay then, so lots of comments coming in about interesting chat that we had. People are on their way to work. Yes, it's almost the weekend. Here it is the weekend in the Middle East. We don't teach on a Friday, but we do teach on a Sunday. So the point I was making, I was talking about the Love to Teach podcast just before I spoke to Bruce. And one of the reasons, interestingly, I gave that up is because in the previous apartment that I lived in, the ceiling was incredibly high. And there was this echo when I was recording. And the point that I was making is about in your home environment for online parents' evening, obviously you've got to make sure that you have got somewhere, a desk or somewhere that a plain background perhaps, and that the Wi-Fi is solid and secure and all of these sorts of things. It was really interesting because, and I say a plain background, because I have a big picture collage in the background where I used to sit. And one of my students asked me about my daughter. I said, my daughter? I don't have any children. She said, well, who are all those photos in your living room? And it was my niece, Ella. And I just thought, oh, wow, very observant. And that didn't bother me at all in the slightest, but it did make me think, oh, okay, I probably should be careful because I didn't realise there's all these photos of my family in the background and so on. So lots of things to think about with the parents' evening, lots of things to think about with the teaching delusion. There's so much in there. Advice that we talked about for giving feedback to teachers. And Bruce made really good points that when teachers become very reflective anyway, that can have a massive impact on us continually learning and progressing. And reflection for me has been one of the best ways that I have improved as a teacher. And we mentioned Robin McPherson quite a bit because Robin wrote the foreword to two of Bruce's books. Robin wrote the foreword to Love to Teach. And now Robin is my co-author. So we have just announced, and I feel like I'm always announcing new books. And people say, how do you do it? Well, The Teaching Life, Professional Learning and Career Progression. That was our summer project. So Robin and I would meet once a month over Google Meet, and we did that for about 6 months. So we were having this meeting for about an hour, and we would just jot down ideas about our vision, what we wanted to include in the book, things that we wanted to include that hadn't been in any other book before, and things that we felt were really important. And then this summer, we got writing. And how that worked was we assigned some chapters. We said, Kate will write this, Robin will write that chapter, and then some of them will both write. But even the chapters I wrote or Robin wrote, we were checking them and editing them and providing feedbacks and adding comments. But I generally think it's just such a different book to anything out there. The first half of the book is about professional learning. We write about the new MPQs. We write about professional learning, including CPD libraries and also other low-cost, high-impact methods of professional learning. And then we have the second section, career progression, advice about interviews and the application process, also about progressing into leadership. And Robin, like Bruce, is head of college, is a headmaster, rector. So Robin was brilliant. We also talked about middle leadership. But one of my favourite chapters in the book, I think it is my favourite chapter, and I'll have to get Robin on as a guest so I can ask him what his favourite chapter is. But my favourite chapter is about non-leadership career progression. And there's some fantastic case studies in there. We have Freya, who is an English teacher in Rome. She's also a Teachers Talk radio host. And Freya is just, she's my inspiration. She's amazing. She's always reading books, attending webinars. She's just loving life, got great balance. And she's a classroom English teacher, and she has held leadership roles. And I do think we need to change our mindset. For some people, the traditional leadership model works, and there are great leaders in education where you go teacher, middle leader, senior leader. But that's not for everyone. And we can still have career progression. And I'm a great example of that, really, I suppose. And my success has been linked to education but outside of my school. And the reason Love to Teach came about was because I applied for an internal job promotion. So I was a teacher at school. I applied for an internal promotion, and it was a head of house role, which we didn't have head of years. So it was the main pastoral role. And I was unsuccessful, and I was really upset. And that's something that I've had throughout my career, that people have said to me, I've tried to gain pastoral leadership and I've been unsuccessful. Because I'm so interested in teaching and learning, everybody said, but you're academic. But I believe that we should all be passionate about academic and pastoral care, because you can't be a pastoral leader who says, I don't care about teaching and learning, because you're still a classroom teacher. So teaching and learning is really important. And you can't be a classroom teacher or head of department who says, I don't care about the pastoral side, because that's hugely important. So we need to break away from pigeonholing people into your academic, your pastoral, because there may be opportunities for movement. So when I didn't get the pastoral role, I felt like, well, I want to challenge and I want to progress. And I'd been blogging and writing and it'd been well received. So I wrote Love to Teach. And then that led to me writing a lot more books. And then that led to me being invited to speak in Hong Kong at events and other events, and my career's just taken off. So I sort of created that opportunity for myself, which has been non-leadership career progression, although I am a middle leader. So yeah, lots of different interesting things in this book. It is available to pre-order now, but it won't be out until the end of November, so I won't be talking about it every week. But I'm just incredibly excited. And this is the first book I've co-authored with someone. And it is really good to have somebody to talk to and bounce ideas off. So we're coming towards the end of the show. Next week, do join me as cognitive scientist Daniel T. Willingham and author of Why Don't Students Like School? We will be having a conversation. So I've got lots of questions to ask Daniel Willingham about memory, about teaching, about advice for teachers, and how we can harness the benefits of cognitive science to help us become the best teachers that we possibly can. So if you missed part of this show, you worry, you can listen back. All Teachers Talk radio shows are available as a podcast. We've had some fantastic shows this week. We had Tom Rogers interviewing Becky Allen. We've got lots of new and exciting hosts. We've had Stacey Ray. It's really good. I'm so proud of the Teachers Talk Radio team and how well it's taken off. Do follow us on Twitter, where you can follow me on Twitter at katejones_teach and give me any feedback. And you can follow at TT Radio 2021. So I hope you enjoyed the show today. I certainly did. Bruce is amazing. So do read The Teaching Delusion 1, 2 and 3. Trust me, you will enjoy them thoroughly and learn a lot. So until next week, take care and stay safe.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.